So I want to talk about the tenfold way. And it's a mathematical and physical concept that's really fascinating to me that became visible in the 2000s due to work on condensed matter physics, although it has roots that go back early, see. And in condensed matter physics, it showed up as a kind of from a classification of states of matter. And what I've been trying to do is to sort of strip it down, strip off some of the complexities of their way of thinking about things and get to the bottom of things. So I won't really be talking about the condensed matter physics side of the story very much at all, but other aspects that have a lot to do with quantum physics. So there are 10 of each of these different things. There are 10 different ways that Hamiltonians can get along with having or not having time reversal symmetry and charge conjugation symmetry. So I'll talk about those. There are 10 different types of irreducible representations if we go from plain old Hilbert spaces up to super Hilbert spaces, which I will explain. Now, when you hear super, you may think I'm talking about supersymmetry in the sense of a symmetry between bosons and fermions, but it turns out that the applications of this math in condensed matter physics are quite different. It's not that. So, I mean, if you have some allergy to supersymmetry as normally practiced, you should not like quit listening to me right now, because it's not going to be that type of talk. There are things called super division algebras, and there are exactly 10 of those, and those show up as well. And it turns out that there are 10 kinds of real and complex Clifford algebras, and I'll explain those too. And so the neat thing is that all of these things are connected to each other. And so I think this is a really fundamental mathematical nexus of ideas that we're beginning to understand here, thanks to the pioneering work in condensed matter physics. So I want to start from the beginning, though, and talk about the threefold way, which was discovered earlier. In fact, I want to start out with some basic ideas in quantum mechanics that probably most of you know, but I'd like to give everyone a nice running start here. So a key fact is that although we describe quantum states by vectors in a Hilbert space, or at least pure states, which are the ones I'm talking about, really the probability, transition probabilities between two such things doesn't change if you multiply one of them by a phase, and neither do if any physical expectation values. So really pure states in quantum mechanics are given by equivalence classes of unit vectors where you count two as the same if they differ by multiplication by a phase or unit complex number. So the set of these equivalence classes is the true set of pure states, and mathematicians would call that projective space, the projectivized Hilbert space. That realization leads to lots of consequences for physics, one of which is Wigner's theorem, proved by Eugene Wigner in 1931, which is a study of what can happen when you have symmetries in quantum mechanics. So suppose you have a map from the projective space to itself that preserves transition probabilities. Well, then it has to either come from a unitary operator, or there's another option, from an anti-unitary operator. So a unitary operator on a Hilbert space preserves everything. It preserves the addition, preserves scalar multiplication, and preserves the inner product. An anti-unitary operator preserves addition, but when you pull a complex number through it, it gets complex conjugated, which is the anti part. And also it complex conjugates the inner product. But both of these, you'll notice, preserve the absolute value squared of the inner product. So they preserve transition probabilities. And the content of the theorem is that there's nothing else that you can do on the projective space that preserves transition probabilities. So that's the fundamental dichotomy. Now, it shows up in interesting ways when we look at symmetries that square to one. Symmetries that if you do them twice on the projective space, they you get back where you started from. So there are some very famous ones, of course, parity, charge conjugation, and time reversal, or perhaps various combinations of these symmetries. And systems may or may not have various ones of these symmetries. So there are various options for symmetries that square to one that show up a lot in physics. So suppose we've got a map from physical states to physical states. I guess I'm saying physical states to mean like they're these equivalence classes of unit of vectors. Suppose we have a map like that that preserves transition probabilities, and when you do it twice, you get back where you started from. Well, so Wigner's theorem says that there are two options. It could come from a unitary operator, or it could come from an anti-unitary operator. When you square that operator, it doesn't need to give you the identity. It could just give you a phase, because the phase doesn't affect the physical state. It doesn't affect the vector mod phases, of course. So we have to allow the possibility that these square to a phase. And then what happens? Well, if it's a unitary operator, you can always make that phase go away. Just redefine your unitary operator by multiplying it by an appropriate phase and get a new unitary operator that also gives the same symmetry on physical states, but squares to one. So in the unitary case, the phases can be sort of erased without any physical effect. It's no big deal, in short. But the anti-unitary case is more interesting, because if you multiply an anti-unitary operator by a phase, it doesn't change that anti-unitary operator squared, because when you move that phase past one of those J's, you get its complex conjugate, so you get CC bar or one showing up. So that you're stuck with the phase in the anti-unitary case. But then there's another little shoe that drops here, which is, see, we know that the operator is anti-unitary, so if you move a phase across it, it gets complex conjugated. But this particular phase C that we're talking about here, it's J squared. So JC is also JJ squared, but J commutes with J squared, of course, because that's how it always works for any sort of operator on anything. But J squared is C, so that we see that, in fact, the phase must commute with J as well as sort of commute with a phase. So that in other words, the only way out is for that phase to be a real number. That's the only way that both of these equations are compatible. And the only real phases are plus or minus one. So you get two choices in the anti-unitary case, that the phase could be plus or minus one. So that's more interesting. So in short, if you have a symmetry that squares to the identity on physical states, it could be a unit, could be implemented by a unitary, in which case you may as well assume it's that unitary squares to one, or it could be implemented by an anti-unitary, and then there are two choices because that could square to one or minus one. So let's dig into the anti-unitary case, because that's the interesting one. Suppose you have a complex Hilbert space with an anti-unitary on it that squares to one. Well, you actually know an example of that. The complex numbers with complex conjugation. The complex numbers are a one-dimensional complex Hilbert space, and complex conjugation is an anti-unitary map that squares to one. So you should think of this case as sort of a souped-up version of complex conjugation. In particular, you can look at the vectors in your Hilbert space that have j psi equals psi. That's like the real line in the complex plane, is the numbers fixed by complex conjugation. That will be a real Hilbert space, a real subspace of your complex Hilbert space. And all the states in your original Hilbert space will be complex linear combinations of states in this real Hilbert space. I should reassure you that although you've probably studied complex Hilbert spaces only, you can go through the whole theory of Hilbert spaces using the real numbers, and it works just fine. There's some aspects that are different, but it's a perfectly sensible concept. What about the other case? If you have an anti-unitary that squares to negative one, that's even more interesting. Then you can do the following trick. You've got I, multiplication by I acts on your Hilbert space, but then you could define a number J, which is this anti-unitary capital J, and you could define a third thing, which I'll call K, which is I times J. And then you can check just from the stuff that I've said, it implies that I, J, and K are, they all square to negative one. And it's also true that I times J times K is negative one. And these are the relations in the quaternions. So we are talking about when Hamilton discovered the quaternions in the pre-talk. And now I can tell you exactly when. October 16th, 1843, he was walking by a bridge and he, after years of thought, discovered the quaternions with these and carved these relations onto the bridge. This is a plaque that was erected in honor of that event. This isn't the original carving, as you'll be glad to know. And the quaternions are a remarkable number system that is like basically the next thing after in the commas. And there's a perfectly reasonable theory of quaternionic Hilbert spaces. And what we've done here is we've seen that our Hilbert space has become a quaternionic Hilbert space because now we know how to multiply elements of our Hilbert space by quaternions. And so if we forget the quaternionic structure on this Hilbert space and only remember I, but not J and K, then we get back our original complex Hilbert space. So we're seeing that both the reals, complexes, and the quaternions are all showing up in quantum physics just from purely physical considerations, not from wanting to stay there or something, but just because they are there. What's so special about those three number systems? There's something very special about them. So when I say an algebra, I'm going to mean a finite dimensional real vector space where you can multiply things and it's associative and multiplication distributes over linear combinations and it has an identity, a multiplicative identity. I mean, there are different things that people mean by algebra, but that's what I'm going to mean now. Then a division algebra is an algebra where you can divide, in other words, where any non-zero element has a multiplicative inverse. What Hamilton was trying to do that took him about a decade before he discovered the quaternions was that he was trying to come up with a division algebra after the complex numbers. He loved the complex numbers and wanted to come up with another division algebra. And he was stuck because he was looking for a three-dimensional division algebra. And it turns out there isn't one. And it was later shown by Frobenius around 1880s or 1890 that there are exactly three division algebras, the real numbers, the complex numbers, and the quaternions. So that's it. So we're seeing that they all show up in quantum mechanics. And the role of the division algebras becomes clear if you focus on systems that have symmetry. So let's talk about unitary symmetries only right now, even though I said that anti-unitary symmetries were an important thing. Let's look at a group G that has a unitary representation on a Hilbert space H. So what does that mean? For every group element, you've got a unitary operator, rho of G, on your Hilbert space, and multiplication in the group gets sent over to multiplication of these operators, and the operator for the identity in your group is the identity operator. That's a unitary representation of a group, and that's how we describe symmetries in quantum physics to a large extent. That is, neglecting the anti-unitaries, that's how we do it. And we're very interested in the building blocks of unitary representations. Those are the irreducible representations, the ones that don't have any interesting sub-representations. In other words, the only closed subspaces of your Hilbert space that are preserved by all the operators rho g are the trivial subspace that's zero dimensional and the whole Hilbert space itself. These are the building blocks from which you can build other more complicated unitary representations. And in the 1960s, Dyson wrote a beautiful paper called The Threefold Way, where he pointed out something that probably people like Frobenius and Schur may have already known, which is that there are three kinds of irreducible representations of groups on Hilbert spaces. So suppose you have an irreducible unitary representation of a group on a Hilbert space, then exactly one of these three options holds. So most of this theorem is easy to see. There's either an anti-unitary with J squared equals negative one that commutes with all the operators rho sub G, or there's an anti-unitary with J squared equals one that commutes with all the rho sub G, or neither. Well, so far, that doesn't sound so exciting because, you know, it's like saying either my shoes are on or they're not. Great theorem. But the thing that makes this into a theorem is that exactly one of these options must hold. So in particular, for example, you can't have both an anti-unitary with J squared equals negative one and one with J squared equals, some other one with J squared equals one, that both commute with the rho sub G. That's like the meat of the theorem. Now we've seen what happens in two of these cases. If you've got an anti-unitary with J squared equals one, commutes with all the rho sub G, then we've seen that there's a real Hilbert space lurking around, namely the vectors that are preserved by J. And so what we have in this case is that our representation is the complexification of a real representation, a representation on a real Hilbert space. That is, you form this representation you've got by taking complex linear combinations of these real vectors. So then we call the representation real. This other case is this quaternionic case. We actually had a representation on a quaternionic Hilbert space, but if we just forget about that and just think of it as a complex representation, then we get back where we started with. And then the other case is that there's no anti-unitary commuting with all those rho sub g's. So then mathematicians call this case that rho is complex. I mean, rho is already a representation on a complex Hilbert space in every case, but we're saying in this case, there's like no trick you can pull. All you've got is this complex story, nothing real or quaternionic going on. So the three division algebras are connected in this beautiful way to the three options for irreducible unitary group representations. And this shows up. So for example, let's look at SU2, the group that we describe spin with. So it has these irreducible representations called the spin J representations for each half integer or integer J. And these are always either real or quaternionic. They always will be some anti-unitary that commutes with all the guys in SU2. And it turns out that this anti-unitary squares to one when J is an integer, the bosonic case, and it squares to negative one when J is a half integer. Notice, by the way, just in case you're getting confused, this J squared has nothing to do with the square of angular momentum. This is the one dangerous feature about calling this thing J. When you're talking about angular momentum, it's dangerous, but that's not what I mean. So for example, the spin one rep of SU2 on C3, that's the complexification of a real representation on an R3. This plain old ordinary representation of rotations on R3 is what gives you the representations of SU2, the double cover of the rotation group on C3 by complexifying. But the more exciting case is the spin one half representation. And what's going on there? Well, that's a representation on C squared, but that's actually the underlying complex representation of a quaternionic representation on the quaternions, H. So this C squared, this space of states of a qubit that you so well know and love, if you think of it just as a representation of SU2, you could say, hey, that actually is the quaternions. So you never knew that the Q in qubit stood for quaternions, but now that's what I'm telling you. Maybe you did know it, but anyway, that's another thing it means besides quantum is quaternion. So how does it work? Well, SU2 is actually the group of quaternions of length one. It's isomorphic to that. And so it acts on the quaternions as by right multiplication. And then that will commute with left multiplication by the quaternions. And so that's how our Hilbert space gets to be a quaternionic Hilbert space by left multiplication. So it's a little tricky, but that's a marvelous fact about how quaternions are hiding right in front of our eyes when we're looking at electrons. So, but it's a general thing. So if you take any unitary representation of any compact Lie group, you can always chop it up into irreducible representations. And then you can do the following. You can take the irreducibles that are sitting inside rho, the pieces, and you can group them into these three different kinds, the real, the complex, and the quaternionic kind. And if you take the sum of all the real ones, the sum of all the complex ones, sum of all the quaternionic ones, you get three different subspaces or sub-representations of your representation. And so every unitary representation of every compact Lie group can be chopped up into three pieces in a God-given way. And the only reason why I'm talking about compact Lie group is because I want some condition that guarantees that the representation is a direct sum of irreducibles. But that's all I'm needing about it. So there's this set of three choices, which I'm going to call three for three choices. And you can think of it as the set -1, 0, 1. You may have wondered why I'm labeling them in this funny way. Well, it turns out that there's a good reason. It's because this is at least a slightly good reason. It's not incredibly profound, but this set of real numbers is closed under multiplication. It's not a group, but it is has this associative multiplication. It's just ordinary multiplication of numbers. And it plays a role because it turns out that if you have two different unitary representations and you take their tensor product, you can figure out how to chop it up into these three kinds of pieces from knowing how you chopped up the two representations you tensored. And the formula is this formula I'm showing you here. So for example, if I wanted to know the quaternionic part of rho tensor rho, I would just look to see, so quaternions means -1. So I'd look to see which pairs of numbers can multiply to -1. Well, those are either -1 and 1 or 1 and -1. So I'd see that my quaternionic part of this would come from the real part of my first representation tensor the quaternionic part of the second, or the other way around, the quaternionic tensor the real. You'll notice that anything multiplied by 0 is 0. So that means that if you have a complex representation, it sort of eats everything else. That is, if you tensor a complex representation with any one of these three kinds, you get a complex one. This sort of is the dominance of the complex numbers over the reals and the quaternions, which probably has something to do with the fact that we tend to just normally just focus on the complex numbers. It's sort of better than the other two in certain objective ways. Okay. Now, the tenfold way. My talk is supposed to be about the tenfold way. I've only 3/10 done. I've been talking about the threefold way. So the tenfold way shows up first in physics and then more mathematically. In physics, it showed up when people were looking at the options for what charge conjugation and time reversal can be like. And in condensed matter physics, when you're thinking about the space of a single particle or hole, you often assume that charge conjugation and time reversal are commuting anti-unitary operators, with time reversal being one that squares to, time reversal can exist. It could square to 1 or -1, or just there could be no time reversal symmetry in your system, and ditto for charge conjugation. So that's 3 times 3 options, or 9 different options for how those symmetries could manifest themselves or not. Or sometimes you have systems that only have a combination of both charge conjugation and time reversal symmetry, which is sometimes called S symmetry. That symmetry will be unitary, and so then you can assume that it squares to 1 by arguments that I mentioned before. So we get a total of 10 options. And they've classified and tried to make condensed matter systems of these 10 kinds. So I'm not really enough of an expert on that, but I had to mention something about that. So a very famous example is this Sue Schrieffer-Heger model of polyacetylene, which is a polymer of carbon and hydrogen that you see shown here that is superconductive at low temperatures. And it actually has solitons that move along it, which are the quasi-particles in their description that arise in from the motion of the electrons, the collective motion of electrons down this polymer. And this model, it's a simple mathematical model that does a pretty good job, apparently, doesn't have charge conjugation or time reversal symmetry separately. But if you reverse particles and holes and you also reverse the arrow of time, there's a symmetry, and that's this S symmetry. So it's an example of this 10th kind of matter. But I was trying to get to the bottom of this mathematically, and I read a beautiful paper by Moore and Fried on this subject, and Greg Moore also has a some nice course notes on this subject, and I've been working based on that those to some extent and trying to strip things down even further. And it turns out that a good way to think about what's going on is that this is all about super Hilbert spaces. So a super Hilbert space is just a Hilbert space that's the direct sum of two other Hilbert spaces, which I'll call H0 and H1. And I'll call H0 the even part and H1 the odd part. So I'll call states in H0 even and states in H1 odd. So that's all I mean by a super Hilbert space. It's nothing fancy if you know what a Hilbert space is. You know what a direct sum is. So it just means that guy and H is a pair of an even part and an odd part. Now, what are you going to do with it? If you're a physicist, you can use super Hilbert spaces in various ways. There's the famous way, which shows up in the term supersymmetry, where you let H0 be some space of bosonic states and H1 be some fermionic states. But in fact, in condensed matter physics, it's not mainly that way that we're using the super Hilbert spaces. So I mentioned this only to discard it, although mathematically that's perfectly fine and you could use this math I'm talking about for that purpose. Instead, it turns out that they will often, in condensed matter physics, let H0 be a Hilbert space for single particle and H1 be a Hilbert space for a single antiparticle or hole. In condensed matter physics, of course, the absence of a particle in some environment can manifest as a hole, which acts like an antiparticle. Also in relativistic quantum mechanics, if you look at the Klein-Gordon equation, you take a Fourier transform of the solution and you find it lives on this mass hyperboloid, and the mass hyperboloid has two sheets. And so you could call wave functions that live up here, H0, and ones that live down here, H1. So that shows up naturally there. Now, in this situation where you have this splitting of the Hilbert space into an even and an odd part, you can think about anti-unitaries. And there are two important kinds of anti-unitary. One which I'll call even, which maps H0 to H0 and H1 to its H1, and one called odd, which switches the two. And in applications to condensed matter physics, T, the time reversal symmetry, is often modeled as an even anti-unitary, and C as an odd anti-unitary, because it's switching particles and holes. So that's why it's odd. I'm going to emphasize, though, that in everything I'm going to say now, I'm not going to insist at all on the interpretation of T and C as time reversal and charge conjugation. So maybe I should not even call them C and T, because for me, that's not what this talk is mainly about from now on. From now on, it's about what happens when you've got even and odd anti-unitaries running around on a super Hilbert space. So the example of charge conjugation and time reversal is just an example, but not really the point of the math. So here's the idea. When you get into this super world, you should think about your groups as being super too, or so a Z mod 2 graded group is a group that is a disjoint union of a bunch of even elements and a bunch of odd elements, with the rule that when you multiply them, they multiply in a compatible way. So even times, it's a little confusing because it gets along with addition of mod 2. So this may sound backwards, but it's true. Even times even is even. Even times odd is odd. And odd times odd is even. That those things, sentences I just said, would have sounded better if I'd said it plus instead of times. But we write the group operation as time, so that's how it comes out sounding. And so when you have a Z mod 2 graded group, you want to look at unitary representations of it on a super Hilbert space. What is that? It's just an ordinary unitary representation, but with the property that it gets along with this even and odd business. So like an even group element times an odd vector will give you an odd vector, or even times even is even, and odd times odd is odd. So this is all motivated by things like what I said, that, for example, time reversal could be like an odd symmetry. Sorry, charge conjugation could be an odd symmetry because it's switching particles and holes. And so you would want this type of rule to hold there. We can define irreducible unitary representations too. And it's just like the definition before, except that the closed subspaces that we care about are ones that are direct sum of an even and an odd part. So for any closed subspace that splits as an even subpart and an odd part, it can be preserved by all the group elements only if it's nothing or the whole Hilbert space. So what I'm just doing here is I'm like copying the usual theory of unitary representations of groups on Hilbert spaces for super Hilbert spaces. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you the thing that's like Dyson's threefold way, is threefold classification of irreducible unitary group representations, but in this super context. And it's called the tenfold way. So the tenfold way says that the irreducible unitary representations of a Z-mod 2 graded group on a super Hilbert space come now in 10 different kinds. And the trick is to look at their commutant, that means the real linear operators, so like linear or antilinear operators, that commute with all the rho g's. And it turns out that there's like a mutually exclusive classification into 10 kinds. In 9 kinds, the commutant could contain an even unitary that squares to 1, negative 1, or not at all, no such t. An odd anti-unitary that squares to 1, negative 1, or not at all. And then there's a 10th kind where you don't have either of those, but you have an odd unitary S that commutes with all the rho sub g's. And in that case, by multiplying it by a phase, you can get it to come out to S squared equals 1. So this is very reminiscent of my classification of matter into 10 kinds based on charge conjugation and time reversal. But I want to emphasize here that we're not talking about time or particles or anything here. We're just talking very generally and abstractly about symmetries of systems where the states come in 2 kinds, even and odd. You always have phases that commute with everything, and those are always even unitary. So those aren't particularly exciting, but they're always there. So we get these 10 kinds. So let's call the set of these 10 kinds X. Let me go Roman on you here and call it X or 10. I'm gonna probably pronounce it 10. So it turns out then, just like we saw in the threefold way, that you can take any unitary representation of a Z-mod 2 graded group that is a direct sum of irreducible parts and chop it up into the pieces, where these pieces are the sums of the irreducibles of the ith kind, where is one of these 10 kinds. And then it turns out that tensor producting works like we saw in the threefold way. Namely, there's a way to add elements of this set 10 that makes this rule hold, so that if I tensor 2 representations, I can figure out how much I form this new representation, rho tensor rho prime. I can look at the piece of it that's of the jth kind, and I can figure it out how it's coming from the various kinds of representations showing up into the 2 representations we're tensoring. So in the threefold way, that set I was calling 3 is just the numbers 0, 1, and negative 1. And I was multiplying them in this type of formula. Here I'm going to call the operation addition. So what is the addition on this 10 element set? Well, it turns out that this set is not a group, but it's a union of 2 groups. It's a union of the integers mod 8 and the integers mod 2. You can't really take the union of 2 groups and make it be a group. But we can make it have this addition where if you're in one or the other of these 2 parts, you just add the usual way. But then if you add something in Z mod 2 and something in Z mod 8, you add them and then you work mod 2. So I'm going to write this 10 element set as like numbers 0 through 7, that's Z mod 8. And then these 2 other numbers in boldface, 0 and 1, Those are the two elements of Z mod 2. So the way addition works is that if you add two light face numbers, you just add a mod 8. If you add two bold face numbers, you add a mod 2. And then the fun part is if you add a light face number and a bold face number, well, here, like you'd say, 6 plus 1, well, that's 7. But then I have to figure out what it is mod 2. So 7 mod 2 is 1. So I'm using this rule here. So that's how it works. So here's a picture of it. And here's a picture of how these 10 different options correspond to the various options for anti-unitaries. Remember, T is an even anti-unitary that could square to 1, negative 1, or just not be there. C is an odd anti-unitary that could square to 1, negative 1, or not be there. And these are the different options. So the Z mod 8 is this outer square. And I'm drawing it as a square because the patterns are a little clearer there. If you notice, the top row of the square has T squared equals 1. The bottom row has T squared equals negative 1. And the middle row doesn't have T at all. Similarly, the columns tell you whether you have C squared equals 1, C squared equals negative 1, or just not at all. And then the Z mod 2 is this little square here. Here you have no symmetries of the C or T type at all. And here you just have the combined symmetry that, or the unitary symmetry that squares to 1 that I'm calling S. So it takes work to show that this really all works out this way, right? I mean, I'm not proving that this is how it works, but this is indeed how it does work. So there's this cool pattern here. Now, we saw that the three-element set was the set of division algebras secretly. And it turns out that the 10-element set is the set of superdivision algebras, which are beautiful mathematical structures that I've only recently been getting into, learning about. So a superalgebra is just an algebra that's split up into an even and an odd part, where the multiplication of elements follows this kind of rule we've been seeing before. So you've got even guys and odd guys. And you know, if you multiply an even guy and an odd guy, you get an odd guy, etc. Then a superdivision algebra is a superalgebra where any non-zero element that is either even, so it's purely an A0, or odd, it has a multiplicative inverse. You'd have other elements that are like linear combinations of even and odd guys, and they don't need to have multiplicative inverses. So this clause here is important. Otherwise, we wouldn't get anything really new. But this clause here means that you get more superdivision algebras than you had division algebras. In fact, you can make the complex numbers into a superdivision algebra in two ways. You could take all the complex numbers to be even. That's a perfectly legit alternative, and it's a division algebra. Or you could take the real numbers to be even and take the imaginary numbers to be odd. And then you'll notice that, like, you know, real times real is real, real times imaginary is imaginary, imaginary times imaginary is real. So it works. So that's a different way to make the complex numbers into a superdivision algebra. It's the same algebra, but it's a different superalgebra. And so this topologist, CTC Wall, came very close to classifying the 10 superdivision algebras. He did, I think, most of the hard work. And then I don't know who finally finished off the job, but the first person I've seen discuss it is Delinia in the IAS notes in a course that had like a semester on string theory at the Institute for Advanced Studies. He gave the classification of superdivision algebras. And there are 10 of them. And they're all algebras of a certain sort called Clifford algebras, either real or complex Clifford algebras. So in 1878, William Clifford, who was far ahead of his time, he generalized the complex numbers in the quaternions by introducing algebras that had more square roots of either +1 or -1, all of which anti-commute with each other. I don't understand why he did this exactly. I have to find out. Later on, they turned to be incredibly important for describing spin 1/2 particles. So the Pauli matrices and the Dirac matrices are basically matrix ways of talking about certain Clifford algebras. And so later on, people realized, oh yeah, Clifford algebra is what you need to describe spinors in arbitrary spacetimes. But this is not why Clifford algebras are showing up for us. So we've got these Clifford algebras, the real Clifford algebras, where you take the real numbers and then you throw in n different square roots of negative one that anti-commute. You could write them down using these commutation relations if you like, which should remind you of fermionic field operators, I guess. So this becomes a super algebra if you treat all these gamma i's as odd elements. And then it turns out you get a lot of super division algebras this way. Clif zero, don't throw in any square roots of negative one. That's just the real numbers. Well, that's a super division algebra where it's purely even. Clif one, throw in a single square root of negative one. Well, that's the complex numbers where we're treating that square root of negative one is odd. So it's a super division algebra thought of where I is treated as odd. Clif two, we throw in two square roots of negative one that anti-commute. Well, we've seen that guy a while back. That's the quaternions. But now we're thinking of it as a super division algebra in a certain way. Clif three is also a super division algebra. Its elements are pairs of quaternions. But then it turns out that Clif four is not a super division algebra. The buck stops at three. You get 2x2 matrices of quaternions, and you can check, you have to work at it, you can check that's not a super division algebra. So we got four of them, four of the 10 super division algebras that way. So where did the rest come from? Well, we could have used square roots of plus one. This may seem perverse, but because I like the Clif n's, I like square roots of negative one better than square roots of plus one. They make more physical sense actually, because believe it or not, a square root of negative one has to do with a 90 degree rotation. But a square root of plus one is sort of a weirder thing to think about geometrically. So Clif negative n for me will be the Clifford algebra where you throw in square roots of plus one. So there's no minus sign in this formula now. And it turns out that if you throw in one, two, or three square roots of plus one, you get certain super division algebras. This means 2x2 matrices of real numbers. This means 2x2 matrices of complex numbers. But when you get to Clif negative four, you don't get a super division algebra anymore. So we got three more. So it turns out, as I said, that neither Clif four nor Clif negative four, when you get that big, it's not a super division algebra anymore, but they're both Morita equivalent to the quaternions, which is a super division algebra if you treat every element as even. So what the heck is Morita equivalent mean? Well, two super algebras are Morita equivalent if they have the same equivalent categories of representations. So you can let super algebras act on super vector spaces, and that's called a representation of a super algebra. That's what we want to do with them. We want to let them act on things like Hilbert spaces. And so two count as equivalent in a certain sense if they have the same categories of representations. And then there's this amazing fact that Clif n plus eight is Morita equivalent to Clif n. So if all you care about is representations, you loop around after you go eight notches on this. And so we can draw it as a kind of clock with eight hours where we go through the Clifford algebras. And here I'm only doing the Clif positive ends. And so these guys, Clif four, Clif five, Clif six, Clif seven, they're not super division algebras, but they're Morita equivalent to super division algebras. So here I'm showing the super division algebras that these are equivalent to. So here are eight super division algebras. And this is the Z mod eight that I was hinting at before when I was talking about this set called 10. So what about the other two? Well, those are the complex Clifford algebras. You can start with the complex numbers and build algebras from them. I've mainly been talking about real algebras so far, but now I'm gonna delve into complex algebras. And so you can define Clifford algebras working with the complex numbers, and you get two more super division algebras. There's a little typo here. I should have come out and say that this is a super division algebra. I mean, it's a typo in that sense that I should have said it's a super division algebra. And there, but if you go past two, you loop around. That is, you get Morita equivalent things to ones you already had. So we get two more super division algebras. So we've got these 10 superdivision algebras describing the 10 possibilities. Well, they're somehow connected to the 10 possibilities for the for symmetries of a super Hilbert space. But you'll notice I haven't quite come out and said how they're connected. Whoops, sorry, I jumped the gun there. So miraculously, there is a correspondence. So in other words, there is a one-to-one correspondence between these three different things that I've mentioned that are 10 of. So there are 10 different ways that you can have unitaries or anti-unitaries that commute with every operator in an irreducible group representation. So this is like the threefold way, but boosted up for super Hilbert spaces. But then there are 10 Morita equivalence classes of Clifford algebras. And in each of those 10 equivalence classes, there is a superdivision algebra, and there are exactly 10 superdivision algebras. So what I have done is I've sort of explained this first bullet point here, and I've sort of explained these second two and how they're connected, but I've made no connection between the first one and the second two. So it turns out, though, that there is a correspondence between this first one and this second one, for example, and it's shown here, but it's harder to prove than I would like. So here what I'm doing is I'm showing the possibilities for C and T symmetries together with the Clifford algebras in the same chart. And so the kind of thing I'm hinting at is this. For example, suppose I have a system that has its anti-unitary symmetry with T squared equals one. Then I can pick out I can think of that as like complex conjugation, and I can pick out a real subspace of my Hilbert space that's preserved by that T anti-unitary. And so then I get a real Hilbert space. A real Hilbert space is something that R knows how to act on. You can multiply by real numbers. And so you get what mathematicians would call, well, I'll call it a representation of Clif zero. Similarly, from these other amounts of symmetry that are shown here, different kinds of symmetry, you can get representations of these different Clifford algebras and vice versa. So there's a correspondence between these, although it's not particularly obvious, right? Because like Clif three, it has three square roots of negative one, that's the definition of it. But then somehow I'm saying that like you can get a representation of that if you have a super Hilbert space that has an even anti-unitary that squares to negative one and an odd anti-unitary that squares to negative one. That's not supposed to be obvious how in the heck that's connected to this. The only argument I know just involves like carefully checking that it is indeed true, not suitable for public consumption. I will say that when we start going around this way around the Clifford algebras, that's where we're throwing in a square root of negative one. And that square root of negative one, it becomes this C. So the I in the complex numbers is the same as this C. It squares to negative one. And it's here. This, when we go back around the other way, when we're throwing in square roots of positive one, that's this C here. So this C squared equals one is coming from throwing in the square roots of that first square root of positive one that we throw in. That partially explains what's going on. It explains why there's T squared equals one down this column. Sorry, why there's C squared is negative one down this column and C squared equals one down this column. But it does not explain the whole thing. So don't feel bad if like this chart remains slightly enigmatic. But that's the story. So we found that there's this mathematical structure governing quantum systems whenever the states in your systems can be naturally split up into states of two different kinds, which I'm just going to call even and odd. Whenever you have that, and whenever you have symmetries that either respect or flip the states of those two different kind, then the system gets classified by the tenfold way. And the Clifford algebras appear out of thin air and these superdivision algebras appear out of thin air and become important in the proceedings. So I'll stop here. That's the story.
All right. Thank you very much. That was a wonderful talk. So are there any questions?
People are probably stunned. I know it's a somewhat highly mathematical talk. It may take people.
Maybe I'll start with one. Do you know, so there are these 10 types. I imagine that people have written down theoretical models that come in all these 10 types.
So one of the
fermion systems.
Yeah. So that is something that I wish I were more of an expert on, but definitely people have made up exactly solvable fermion systems where you have like many fermions with just quadratic interaction terms. So you can write them down, quadratic and annihilation and creation operators that have any one of these 10 kinds of symmetries. And they show that some of these types of system naturally show up in fermion models in certain dimensions of space-time, that is, you know, wires, thin films, or 3D bulk material, and others do not. And so there's a nice connection there that people have worked out. Yeah. So that's a further elaboration of the tale where we take this stuff here, which is just sort of the abstract study of symmetry, and then we start looking at specific kinds of condensed matter systems and see which have the symmetry. And so a bunch of them have been made in the lab. And so I just mentioned the one, the polyacetylene superconductors, but there are others. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it sounds from what you say that maybe not all 10 classes have been seen experimentally yet, or
I wasn't able to get somebody to admit to having seen all 10 of them. I'm a little frustrated because I was hoping that somewhere there'd be a paper that would have like a wonderful chart listing all 10 kinds and saying for each kind what realizes that. And I've seen sort of fragmentary charts of that sort, but they don't cover all of the systems. And I think that probably it's because some of the systems for free fermion models, you just can't build them until you get up to like four-dimensional systems. But that doesn't mean that you could not realize those symmetries using some non-free system. So there might be other ways to get at them.
Hank?
Hank Chen?
Yes. Thank you for the very interesting talk. I'm just wondering, is there a similar classification result for like Zn graded algebras?
Ah, yes, there is. I've only seen mathematicians looking at that and not too many. So yeah, so I've been talking about Zmod 2 all over the place. Zmod 2 graded everything. And there is something better about Zmod 2 than Zmod 3 or Zmod 7. But mathematicians have looked at Zmod n graded algebras and Zmod n graded Zmod n graded superdivision algebras. I don't know what the name for them is. And they are somewhat understood. And I actually like was looking at them and trying to figure out like, would they be interesting? One thing I'll say is that like with Clifford algebras, you're getting all these square roots of one and negative one showing up. It turns out that if you were like doing Zmod 3, it would be cube roots that become important. So Clifford algebras would not be the thing to think about then. It would be some other kind of algebras where you had like cube roots of unity. And I wish some physicists would invent some system where the states came in like three different kinds and there were symmetries that would like permute those or rotate around those three different kinds. Then there'd be like some use for this.
Right, like maybe fractional quantum Hall.
Maybe. Yeah, I don't, how much does Zmod n show up a lot in that? I thought it was sort of like some of the different stuff. Maybe it does.
Yeah, there. At least from what I know, there are composite fermion models, or yeah, composite fermion pictures of fractional quantum Hall effect that kind of fractionalizes the electron into like three, for example, or whatever odd number of charges, I guess.
Okay, well, that would be really cool if there was some, that was physically realizable. Back in the old days, I knew mathematicians who were studying like braid group actions on some kind of vector spaces that are like super vector spaces, but with Z mod n. I think they would use a word like color groups or something like that back then. At the time, they had no particular strong physical motivation for doing that. So I actually had almost forgotten that line of work. But you're giving me some ideas. So yeah, so there may in fact be some things there. And that would be pretty interesting because I think the story gets richer when you look at Z mod n and you get n to be bigger. It gets more, you get more kinds of stuff going on.
Right. Thank you.
Uh-huh. That's great.
Could you say a little bit more? I don't know if this is a question for John or for Hank, but so the Z2 I thought here was related to the fact that there's two possibilities in Wigner's theorem, unitary or anti-unitary, basically. And the two is that if you have an anti-unitary thing and you square it twice, you get back to it to a unitary thing. If you square it, you get a unitary thing. Then there's the Z2 of kind of statistics, like boson versus fermion on statistics under exchange, which sounds more related to anions. Is that Z2?
I'll say a bit, and Hank could. I'd be happy to hear him say a bit. I think there are like a couple of Z mod twos going on here. So there's the unitary anti-unitary distinction that is, you know, square an anti-unitary, you get a unitary. But then here we're looking at a Z mod 2 graded Hilbert space. And so then you have a way to take operators and say they're even and odd. And you could, and they can, an odd one will square to an even one and so on. So, and those are separate things. So here I'm talking about anti-unitaries that are even and odd, but you could have unitaries that are even or odd as well. So I think if you went to a Z mod 3 graded Hilbert space, you'd still have, unitaries and anti-unitaries, that would stay Z mod 2, but you'd have more options for this. You wouldn't just have like even and odd, you'd have three kinds of them. So, it's easy to get mixed up when everything is coming in twos. In some ways, that would like help sort out what's really going on here to do a case where you had a Z mod 3 running around. Sorry, I don't know if Hank had some different kind of stuff to say about that, but that's what that made me. Occurred to me is that there are like a couple of Z mod 2s lurking in here.
Yeah, I guess I don't really have anything much to say aside from the fact that, I guess the statistics, the anions that we have, that Z mod n could be coming from that. I guess this is related to the colored grades that John was talking about. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, I'll think about this. I thought I saw maybe Samuel. Yeah, you had a question.
I was just wondering, like, so another place where there's kind of a interesting Z mod 2 thing that comes up, like if you look at Pauli groups or Heisenberg groups, there's one way to look at the group law where it involves like a bilinear form that's valued in like if you're looking at like qdits, it would be maybe valued in zd or like z mod d, or in the even case it could be z mod 2d, depending. There's kind of two different versions you can look at, and so I'm wondering if like does this at all like motivate you to look at like Clifford algebras, not over the reals or complexes, but over like ZD or something like that?
I can't really instantly answer that because I just don't quite know. I will say that you can you can definitely look at Clifford algebras over different fields and over different rings, and mathematicians have intensively studied them. So if anyone ever, so if you ever dream up a use for them, we'll be ready. But then on the other hand, there's another direction that could be gone into, which is that, I mean, well, I think I already mentioned this, that if you're looking at, if you have Z mod D gradings running around, you may get interested in the Z mod D version of division algebras instead of superdivision algebras. And if you do that, that is, if you're trying to like come up with an analog of this classification of, sorry, I'm not finding it, of superdivision algebras, but with Z mod 2 replaced by Z mod D, then you would see not Clifford algebras showing up. So an analog of this type of result, you wouldn't see not Clifford algebras showing up primarily, but other kinds of algebras. I just don't know enough about what you're doing there to like fit in the slot in the best math.
Okay. I guess another thing that kind of makes me wonder is like the relationship between like quadratic forms being kind of the same thing as a symmetric bilinear form ends up breaking down in characteristic two.
Yes.
And like the Clifford algebras seem like they might be like a way to actually like see into the interesting side of it, which seems to be the quadratic forms where there's like quite a bit more of them. And so I don't know.
I've avoided characteristic two because it makes everything weird. And but yes, yes, things would get very, you know, you can either avoid things because they get too complicated, or you can dive into them because you love them and you're like bored with all the usual stuff. And so working with Clifford algebras over characteristic two would be pretty interesting. So for example, like there's quadratic form over Z mod 2 in 8 dimensions, where if you look at its group of geometries, you find that it's the Weyl group of the group E mod 8. That is the same as like the some kind of discrete symmetries of the group E8. So there's like a way that just like messing around with 8 bits and some quadratic form on it, you get like yanked into studying E8. So there's lots of stuff there if you have the mind for it. Mm-hmm. But I'm not mainly a finite characteristic guy. Yeah.
Lee, question?
Yes, this is going to be a very naive question, but thank you for the talk. You know, we used to think about prion models in terms of gradings and so forth. Do you see any mathematics that could help us?
I don't know about how prion, I know what a prion model is, but I don't know how they're related to gradings. Are they, what kind of gradings?
Make a prion model. The prion model is a model for substructure of quarks and leptons, and you can get one, for example, by taking braids in groups of three, and you have a story about the standard model particles.
Yeah, sorry, I can't help you on the spot there, but you're giving me another possible reason to look at like the Z mod 3 graded version of this story that I was talking about. Yeah, I hadn't at all expected that like the conversation would turn to be focused on Z mod n for n other than two. But that but that's now you're getting me interested in that. So sorry, I can't. I don't know enough to like say, oh yeah, this is just what you need for prion models, or no, it's not. I just don't know.
Sure. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah. You're muted, Latham.
Oh, sorry. All right. So if the questions have petered out, that's a great place to stop because we're over time. So let's thank John for a wonderful talk. Very stimulating.
Great. Thanks very much.